Good morning. Maui County is continuing to consider whether it should recommend a move to a county manager system. Tony Takitani, the chair of the special committee investigating the idea, joins us today. And on the GOP caucus day in Hawaii, we'll check in with Neil Conan about the big wins that could be happening in other states. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Maui Humane Society is setting up a mobile surgical MASH unit for several hundred good reasons. CEO Jerlene Bryant will tell us why. And psychologist Joyce Lechuga offers a workshop in dealing with loss.
It's Tuesday, March 8th. Stay here for the conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
So Maui is taking a look at the way it governs itself, huh?
Right. You might remember that we began to talk about that late last fall. And, you might ask yourself this question: what is the most effective form of civic government? Now, the answer, of course, may depend on who you ask. And right now, as we mentioned, Maui County is doing the asking. Last December, we talked about the formation of a special committee to consider whether Maui County should move to a council manager system. With six meetings already under its belt, the committee will again meet this Thursday. Members are expecting to hear more public testimony, but first this morning, we're going to hear from the chair of the Special Committee on County Governance, Tony Takitani, who joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just to backtrack just a bit, what precipitated the question of whether Maui County should change its form of government?
I think that's a very important question, but I think primarily our county council and our mayor are not getting along very well, and it seems to have risen to a different level.
When did you notice at that point or that split was going to take you off in this other direction to potentially look at a different form of government altogether?
I think shortly before I was appointed to this governance committee, there was some coverage in the newspaper that they were actually going to create one, and there seemed to be a little bit of a rush to do it. So I put my name in the hat, and here we are.
When you say here we are, where exactly do you think we are?
We've had approximately six public meetings, five or six, I'm not certain. We've studied the issue. We've taken quite a bit of testimony. Primarily most of the same people, but we're expecting, it's the first time Thursday night that we're having a public hearing after hours. So we're having one more open public hearing, and it's pretty open. You can pretty much say anything you want to say. Our charge to the committee is kind of focused. The council, in their resolution that created this committee, asked us to consider whether establishing a county manager form of government for the county of Maui would improve management and operation of the county government. That is basically the question. But we've allowed testimony or people to just basically speak their piece as to any form of county government.
Sort of getting a lot of what they have to say off their chest?
It could be, yeah. Could very well be that.
And before, when you mentioned after hours, you're talking about after a work day so that maybe it might be open to more people to get something off their chest.
That's correct.
Okay, so just to draw those very clear distinctions between a council manager situation and what is existing now, the council mayoral system, what are the key differences in terms of how it operates, except that you have that now someone who acts like a city CEO if you go to the manager system?
I think the main thing that we're dealing with here is right now we have a mayor that is elected by the people. What is being looked at or considered is a system in which the county council or some other way, some other method, but I haven't There could be any type of method you can use, but I haven't heard any other method other than the county council selects the CEO or county manager, and the county manager then selects the department heads.
Of all of the testimony that you've heard so far, all the conversation on this, is the split pretty deep, or is there sort of more coalescence on one side or the other?
Well, there hasn't been a whole lot of testimony right now. We're trying to allow more time and using different hours to get more people involved in giving testimony. But it's been pretty weighted toward the county manager side.
Except if you talk to the mayor.
Well, if you talk to the mayor and a couple of other people that have testified on the other way. I think the former mayor, Charmaine Tavares, also testified that maybe there's some other tweaks that should be considered rather than making a big change like this at this time.
So what would those tweaks be?
I think she mentioned things like changing the qualifications of the managing director. She mentioned using the budgeting power of the county council a little smarter. I think there was one other thing that she mentioned, but it escapes me right now.
As you're going to have this next meeting with the first opportunity for a lot of people perhaps to be able to go and find out more about this, is there a sense that there is a building momentum toward this kind of move as opposed to just tweaking what the system is right now?
I not really. I think there's testimony. There's been a consistent small group of people that have been testifying. And we're hoping that more people will come out.
But this isn't something that so far you'd say is a major movement.
I would not categorize it in that way.
You've got a deadline, though, of what, June 1st coming up?
Something like, I think it's August.
Well, so you still have some time is the point.
We do have some time, but we'll try to use it in a smart way. We're doing some studies. We're looking at studies that have already been done.
And there have been quite a few.
And there have been quite a few. And you know, one of the proponents of this change are really pushing that, you know, it's supposed to take some politics out of this. There's a continuity in the administration. There's a professionalism. And yet some of the studies show that you don't really remove any politics from it. There's not necessarily any evidence, and there's decades of studies that have showed that there's not any real evidence that shows one type of form is better than the other type. And the one downside I would say to this is that voter turnout drops.
Which is one of the issues that you're also facing now, as is most of the state. But the bottom line question to what you've just said seems to be, well, can you really take politics out of the situation?
Good question. I other than picking somebody's name out of the hat, I don't see how you do that. You know, when you have the county council selecting the manager, you still have 9 elected people who still have to run campaigns, who still have to raise funds, and so I'm not certain that it exactly does that either.
Which seems to be the point in considering this. How many communities across the nation actually have a council manager situation as opposed to?
There are many, but none quite like Maui County would be my guess. In some of the studies, I haven't seen anybody quite like us with 3 islands and such a diverse type of community that I know of.
That would be kind of impossible.
Kind of impossible.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We'll see how this meeting goes and if there's a lot of folks who turn out to testify.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Aloha.
Aloha. Tony Takitani is the chair of the Special Committee on County Governance. The Maui meeting to hear testimony on what form of civic government Maui County wants will happen on Thursday at 5 o'clock at the UH Maui College. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now coming up to 8:15, and we'll be coping with pet overpopulation on Maui a little later in the show. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a community resource that most of us take for granted until we need it. The Blood Bank of Hawaii is the sole provider of blood and blood products to all civilian hospitals throughout the islands. Its goal is to provide a safe and adequate blood supply for childbirth, trauma, surgery, transplants, and the treatment of life-threatening medical conditions. It takes upward of 200 blood donors every day to meet the needs of Hawaii's population, and the bank's blood donor programs are essential to its mission. It was originally known as the Honolulu Blood Plasma Bank and opened its doors on the grounds of what is now the Queens Medical Center. For today's Backyard Quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the year the Honolulu Blood Plasma Bank opened and began providing its much-needed services. Call us with the answer at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Laurel Nakanishi, a MPI grad. You're listening to member-supported HBR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Most of us hate to think of animals suffering. We see our ability to care for them as an index of our humanity. Yet, in large numbers, they end up on their own. They're dropped off every day at the Maui Humane Society and at humane societies around the islands. And for too many, that's the last stop. The Maui Humane Society looks to events like its Mobile Animal Surgical Hospital spay and neuter clinic for dogs to stem the tide. And we talked about the effort with Humane Society Chief Executive Officer Jerlene Bryant.
The idea behind it is that we have too many animals on the island, mm-hmm. and it doesn't balance out with the number of adopters that we have looking to add pets to their home.
And so, inevitably, that means what?
Inevitably, it means that we have to work harder to find what we call live release options for our animals. I took over at the shelter about 20 months ago, a little over 18 months ago. And when I took over, I obviously was looking at our stats, and that would be how many animals we have coming in, how many each year we're able to reunite with their families if they were lost, how many adoptions we do, how many transfers, mm-hmm. how many spay and neuters. And while we, at the time, were working at max capacity, the numbers weren't changing each year. So that prompted me to look at options, more aggressive options. And so about a year ago, we launched our high-volume, high-quality spay-neuter campaign, a.k.a. MASH clinics.
Uh-huh.
And that was about a year ago, last April.
Have those changed the numbers discernibly?
Slightly. There's quite a delayed reaction. You won't see an immediate decrease in your shelter intake numbers, but we're very optimistic that we will. Just this last month, in February, was our last MASH clinic, and in 4 days we sterilized 714 animals.
Wow.
And that's pretty amazing. Even in the high volume spay-neuter clinic world, if you will, those numbers are pretty amazing.
Well,
and so tomorrow starts our next clinic.
And you can also see, Jerlene, how that number, that statistic, wouldn't be reflected for a couple of years, but 700 is a huge number for sure.
Yeah.
When you say that when you took a look at the numbers mm-hmm. A year or so ago mm-hmm. and the percentages of you know, animals rescued, restored to original owners and mm-hmm. things like that, what kind of rough percentages were they?
Well, to give you just as an example, Every year we take in about 8,000 to 10,000 animals. That's 22 to 25 animals every day coming through our doors.
Wow.
Every day of the year, 365 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, our adoption numbers, we would adopt out about 1,900 animals or so. We would reunite about 700 to 800 animals. We would spay and neuter just over 3,000 animals a year, and that's out of our very small veterinary clinic.
What was that total number again?
What?
The total number.
We would bring in somewhere, like for example, last year, fiscal 15, we received almost 8,000 animals through our door.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And so each year, those numbers were staying very stagnant. And, you know, while there's multiple agencies on the island that offer, you know, that are trying their best to decrease the number of animals on the island, we, as the only open admission shelter, felt that we really needed to take lead on this and be very aggressive in our spay and neuter campaign. But at the same time, adopting out as many animals as we can. We do that through adoption promotions, transferring as many animals as we can to our transfer partners on the mainland. We transferred 470 animals off of the island last year to the mainland. You know, and those are great programs, but our main focus is to decrease the number of animals being born on this island that ultimately are not going to find a home.
And those animals, that, you know, the thing that amazes me, Charlene, and I'm sure you've had many opportunities to reflect on this, is that everyone objects to animal cruelty. It's almost as if it's more offensive to us than cruelty to people sometimes.
For some of us, yeah.
And yet yet this goes on. And I think that, you know, they're well-meaning people just sort of letting it happen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and animal cruelty is, it's subjective, too. My idea, you know, to me, having an animal tethered up in a backyard its entire life and never integrating it into your family and making it part of your family is cruel.
Sure.
For some people, that's all they've known. That's what they grew up with, and so that's how they treat animals, and in their mind, that's not cruel. Of course, we have actual animal cruelty where somebody is, you know, inflicting pain or serious neglect on the animal, but there's other forms also.
Yeah, no, and I was using the term animal cruelty in the very broadest sense in terms of allowing, you know, allowing situations like the ones you face to develop in the first place.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. We, the Maui Humane Society holds the animal control contract for the island of Maui, and so we see a wide range of we see all the good and all the bad.
Sure.
For sure.
Sure.
I like to say that we see the best and the worst in people when it comes to animals.
Let's focusing for a moment on the best in people. You get volunteer help, right?
We do. Yeah. We rely on that greatly. Last year, our volunteers donated about 17,000 hours to the shelter.
That's an encouraging bit of news, isn't it?
They did that in a variety of ways. If somebody comes to talk to us and they're interested in volunteering, we have a place for them. For some people, it's dog walking and spending time with our dogs. For some people, it's spending time with our cats. For some, it's answering phones and helping in the front office or, you know, folding newsletters, helping with outreach events, education. I mean, there is a place. If you have some time to spare and you like animals, there is a place here.
Well, Jerlene, if we accomplish nothing else, maybe this conversation will send a few people your way. You can always use more volunteers, right?
We absolutely could. Absolutely. I mean, right now, even with our great volunteer support, our dogs that are up for adoption, not every dog gets walked every day. And until we have our dogs out of their kennels every day, we are going to be actively seeking more volunteers. I mean, and again, for other things than just walking dogs, but that one area is very critical to the enrichment and welfare of our animals while they're here.
Jerlene Bryant is the Chief Executive Officer of the Maui Humane Society. which is offering a mobile animal surgical hospital spay and neuter clinic for dogs today through Saturday. The organization is still in need of volunteers with medical experience to assist with those dogs' post-op recovery, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aren't any miracles to be had in Michigan.
You better shop around.
In the race for the White House, mojo matters more than Motown. Hillary and Trump are rolling, but what do Michigan voters want to see for their state and for the rest of the race? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Station members make the connection between using this service and helping to pay for it. One way to demonstrate your loyalty is through continuous monthly giving. Mahalo to sustaining members Robert and Janie Iwai of Honolulu, Kenneth Kaneshiro of Aiea, and Beverly Futa of Honolulu. As more listeners become sustainers, we can all look forward to fewer programming interruptions for fundraising. To become a sustaining member at the dollar a day level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks a bunch. For 2 hours tonight, Hawaii's Republican Party will caucus. Splits among the state's GOP members have been surfacing for months. House Minority Leader Beth Fukumoto Chang maintains her longtime stance against Donald Trump. Yesterday, former Congressman Charles DeJoux sent an open letter contra Trump and pro-Kasich, as Senator Sam Slom moved to support Ted Cruz once Ben Carson dropped his candidacy. Meanwhile, a profanity-filled robocall showed up to Civil Beat. That could make a lot of the GOP party faithful wonder what happened to their party. Reporter Chad Blair is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Republican Caucus Day, Beth Ann.
Yeah, that too. But let's talk about that robocall for a moment, insofar as we can talk about it, because, boy, it's nasty.
Yeah, we actually have the audio up on our website. It actually came to my telephone, a Florida address, area code rather, and It initially seemed to be for Trump. It said it was paid for by a Trump Hawaii organization, but it doesn't appear that is the case. In fact, it seems like it's just the opposite, a push-pulling call, if you will, an attack on Donald Trump. It's pretty brutal. There is profanity, but it gives you an indication that every vote is precious, or I guess I should say every delegate is precious, and there are 19 delegates that are up for grabs in tonight's GOP caucus here.
I know nationally there seems to be an impulse to minimize what's going on in Hawaii because we have 19 delegates. But to us, it's very important. To the people who are here, it's very important. As you look at how the stance of the GOP has been changing, do you think there's any chance for this to in any way unify the party?
No. In fact, I would say the opposite. It's really showing the same kind of divisions that we are seeing nationally. Particularly the folks that are supporting Ted Cruz here are very aggressive. Many of them, or some of them, I don't know the exact count, but certainly a number of them are part of a group that's called the Hawaii Republican Assembly, a breakaway group that feels that the local Hawaii Republican Party is just way I'll just put it this way, not conservative enough, and therefore they should really support Ted Cruz being the only true conservative. Remember that Jeb Bush, was in many ways the establishment candidate, and a lot of party elders supported his candidacy, including Pat Saiki, the former party chair, former congresswoman. But as you know, he crashed and burned early. There are also aggressive candidacies in the part of Marco Rubio and John Kasich. You mentioned DeJoux just recently. Duke Iona, the former lieutenant governor, coming out for Rubio as well. I'm seeing nobody's uniting behind a single candidate, and the attacks on each other are getting harder and harder as the caucus approaches.
Traditionally, Hawaii didn't like nastiness. And, would duck and run for cover when that started to happen and shake its head. But after the past couple of election cycles that we've seen where there's been a lot of that, have we just fundamentally changed?
You know, I think nastiness in politics has always existed, including here in Hawaii. I could tell you some stories from back in the day. It may be less pronounced, and when it does become pronounced, it's quickly denounced. That's just not us. We will not tolerate that sort of treatment of each other politically. But in fact, it exists. We're as human as our counterparts on the mainland. Politics is a blood sport. There is, in fact, a lot at stake. In this case, the presidency of the United States.
But I don't remember ever getting a robocall like the one that you have up on your site.
I do remember some things in some local races in the past. In terms of presidential candidates, that may be a first. I don't quite remember that kind of a brutal phone call coming. But look what's going on right now nationally with Mitt Romney and John McCain, former nominees, denouncing very strongly Donald Trump, the current front runner. But certainly with social media and the way things are with the Internet, the viciousness can go to a whole nother level.
All right. Well, we're watching that right now, and we're going to wait and see how this plays out. We'll know. It won't be long for Hawaii to know tonight, will it?
No, we'll know soon, and we'll be reporting it at Civil Beat, and I'm sure at HBR, too.
And we'll be talking about it, no doubt, you and I, tomorrow. Thanks very much, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Everyday Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins me for a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The continued success of Donald Trump set off seismic shifts in the Republican Party. Hillary Clinton has a commanding lead among Democrats. Internationally, Turkey dictates an immigration deal to a divided Europe. And so far, the Syrian ceasefire continues to hold. That's what news analyst Neil Conan is considering this week. He joins us most Tuesdays from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. And Neil, I got to ask you, have you ever seen anything like what's happening with the Republican Party?
Well, nothing quite like that last debate. No, I'll have to admit that, but you know, I think you have to go back to the late 60s and early 70s when it was the Democratic Party that tore itself apart. But even then, you know, to see the last two Republican presidential nominees come out and say they could not bring themselves to support the leading candidate of the party, wow.
What a big wow. First things first, okay. Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee 4 years ago, called for the other candidates in the race to cooperate with each other, you know, to play nice in sort of an anti-Trump coalition. Something like, well, maybe John Kasich asked his supporters in Florida to vote for Rubio. Maybe Marco Rubio asked his backers in Ohio to back Kasich. Was this Romney trying to be relevant? I mean, it sure like his call looked like that this call fell flat.
Oh, it absolutely fell flat. And Romney, you know, he says, you know, he's not going to ride in on a white horse and try to be the savior of the Republican Party. Mm. I think he was trying to speak maybe a couple of months too late, but to, you know, his real concerns about the future of the party and where it's headed. But it absolutely fell flat. All three of those candidates rejected the idea. Now Ted Cruz is making a concerted push into Florida, which, of course, makes it even tougher there for Marco Rubio in his home state. Florida votes next Tuesday, of course, along with Ohio. Now it's, you know, next Tuesday it's win or go home for both Rubio and Kasich. And, you know, maybe, you know, by Wednesday next week, Ted Cruz hopes that he's the last man standing next to Donald Trump.
Cruz did win his home state last Tuesday, and he did pretty well on Saturday, too.
He did. But his problem is that the election calendar now moves to more moderate places, blue states, you'd have to say, places like Michigan today, next week Ohio. Florida may not be very comfortable territory for Cruz. Then on to the big northeastern states and the Midwest, places that look very different from Texas and Oklahoma and Iowa. You know, Cruz isn't actually that far back in the delegate count right now, but a lot of those upcoming primaries are going to be winner-take-all, and Donald Trump's lead could grow very quickly.
Interesting a little while ago that you mentioned the Democratic Party's implosion. It was almost, what, 50 years ago. A mm-hmm. lot of people are tracing this breakup in the Republican Party back to Richard Nixon and the Southern strategy in 1968, yeah?
No, absolutely right. Nixon deliberately set out to lure disaffected Democrats in the old Confederacy. But, you know, that was only possible because they felt betrayed by the Democratic Party that had been their home for so long. Liberal Northern Democrats embraced the civil rights movement and forced the Southern Democratic Party to desegregate. And over time, an entire generation of Southern white politicians switched parties. What had once been the solid Democratic South, you know, the old FDR coalition, became the solid Republican South. 50 years later, Southern whites form a major part of the Republican Party base. Then it was Ronald Reagan who attracted a lot of, you know, blue-collar whites in northern states, the so-called Reagan Democrats. And the party in the past several years has increasingly tried to win national elections with a big majority of the white vote. That's a smaller and smaller part of the American demographic, a smaller and smaller part of the electorate. It's also, you know, that's the Tea Party. That's the Trump voters who say they feel betrayed by the Republican leadership. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, on the other side, going back again to 1968, those finally enfranchised African-Americans have become the most loyal part of the Democratic Party base.
And this time it seems the most loyal part of Hillary Clinton's base, too. I mean, that's what's made it possible for her to hold off that populist challenge from Bernie Sanders, right?
Exactly. Senator Sanders does well in New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine. He does well in caucus states where organization and enthusiasm matter so much. But with those black votes, Secretary Clinton crushed him all across the South on Super Tuesday. Saturday, Senator Sanders goes 2-for-3, but her margin in Louisiana was so big that she earned more delegates that day than he did. And I think she can expect similar results today in Mississippi. And the polls show her well ahead in Michigan, though both campaigns say it's going to be closer than it looks like in the polls.
So, okay, this still sounds like it's Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
More than ever. yesterday, Michael Bloomberg announced that he is not going to run a third-party campaign. There is an awful lot of money coming into the, you know, anybody but Trump advertising efforts. But, you know, there's no plausible alternative candidate to rally around, no plausible way to deny Mr. Trump the nomination at the convention. This is going to be his party, and much of that Republican establishment that he so loves to bully is going to have to decide, you know, do they, hold their nose and back Donald Trump? Do they try to form it? What are they going to do?
Okay, well, we got to leave that there for a second, but I wanted to ask you about a couple of international stories. Yesterday, Turkey proposed a deal on immigration to the European Union. Some are describing that as blackmail. What's going on?
Well, it's interesting. We just heard that Deutsche Welle newscast, and half the items were all about Turkey.
Exactly.
Now, weren't they? Turkey can control the flow of refugees into Europe, or at least most of it. The pace of migration is even bigger this year than last. It's 160,000 people so far in 2016. That pace will pick up as the weather improves. So what Turkey proposed is that Europe send back migrants who come in illegally, don't qualify as refugees, send them back to Turkey. For every Syrian who is returned back to Turkey, Europe agrees to accept a Syrian who applied for refugee status in one of the camps on the Syrian-Turkish border. That's called the one-for-one deal. But that is not all. Turkey asked for another 3 billion euros in aid. That's, what, $3.3 billion. And to accelerate the long-stalled talks on Turkey's membership into the EU. So if this works, and that's far from clear that it's going to work, Europe will agree to hold its nose on Turkey's human rights record. We just heard about those protests mm-hmm. over the seizure of that newspaper this past weekend, in return for a system that could, you know, actually sharply reduce the flow of migrant boats across the Aegean and sort of, you know, regularize this refugee crisis.
Turkey, though, is a major player in Syria against President Assad, against the Islamic State, even more against the Kurds. Does Turkey really expect European support for its policies in Syria?
Absolutely. Sure. Why not? They've got the whip hand here. President Erdogan wants to set up a safe zone inside Syria. He argues that would keep, you know, the Syrians in Syria, they'd basically be in refugee camps on the other side of the Turkish border. But it would give him a way to protect his allies in Syria, the Turkmen communities, and another way to pursue his war on the Kurds.
The ceasefire, well, at least let's call it that partial ceasefire in mm-hmm. Syria, is still holding for the most part. And there are supposed to be those peace talks in Geneva this week. Yeah.
Well, the Russian and the Syrian air forces are still bombing what they call terrorists. There are fewer attacks than before. There have been some incidents on the ground, many complaints about the volume of food and medicine being delivered to rebel areas. There is absolutely no consensus among that, you know, dizzying array of rebel groups about whether they're going to attend these peace talks or not. And unless you can start to see some momentum, some tangible political progress, it seems inevitable that the ceasefire is going to fray.
One question before we have to say goodbye for this week. Back to politics. We forgot to mention that Hawaii's Republicans are also caucusing today. We talked about that a little earlier in the reality check, but I wanted to hear some more from you about that.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I don't think anybody has a clue about who's ahead. You know, there's some suspicion about Marco Rubio. He's the only one who's been running ads here. But nobody polls in Hawaii. I think it's anybody's guess.
Well, maybe not going to be such a guess for the Democrats when they poll later on this month, and we'll talk about that then, too. Thanks, Neil.
Talk to you next week, Beth Ann.
We'll talk to you then. Neil Conan is our news analyst, and he joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Now back to our backyard quiz and a valued community institution, one you might think we always had with us. In fact, it started as a military facility, the Honolulu Blood and Plasma Bank, operating out of the Queen's Hospital. It was operated as a wartime agency with the outbreak of World War II, but converted to civilian status in 1942. Over the years, the name changed to Blood Bank of Hawaii. And services were expanded to include neighbor island blood drives. Hawaii's unique ethnic population became nationally recognized as a source for many types of rare blood. Today, the Blood Bank of Hawaii supplies life-saving blood products from over 60,000 blood donations collected from more than 28,000 volunteer blood donors every year. This morning, we asked you to name the date of its founding, which was February 1941.
And Michelle Grotstein of Kaneohe knew the answer. Congratulations, Michelle. You have a T-shirt winging its way to you. And that's our quiz today at 8:47. If you've got a quiz, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
There's no pain like the loss of a loved one, but even as it hurts us, we want to honor that memory by living well in the honor of the person we've lost. Bereavement is a struggle for the best of us, and psychologist Joyce Lechuga is offering a workshop in reconnecting with life after loss on Maui. She joins us from there. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning.
Most of us feel pretty helpless when faced with a real serious bereavement, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. That's a big part of experiencing the death of a loved one, is feeling totally hopeless and helpless.
Because there's nothing we can do about it, obviously.
That's correct. There is nothing you can do about to change the death of a loved one. It happens to everybody eventually. We all will face that experience. And the people we leave behind will grieve like we grieve now when we lose a loved one.
you know, I found myself thinking about what would one say to one's loved ones if you could speak from, you know, beyond the veil. And I think a lot of it would be, don't mope around, you know, live your life, right?
Well, I think that's totally correct. But, you know, it's so important to realize that in the beginning, when one loses a loved one at first, the first months and sometimes many months,
mm-hmm.
There's almost nothing you can say because the bereaved is experiencing all of the feelings and the emotions of that loss, and they're confused. Everything is changing. It's hard to make decisions. So we, as people who are working with the bereaved, know that the most important thing we can do in the beginning is just to listen. And there's very little we can say. And everybody does it a little differently. They deal with a loss a little differently. As time goes on, however, then the more people can talk and share their story, so to speak, and the grief that they're feeling, and then that, just that in itself is so healing for them.
Joyce, I think it's important that you recognize that in those early stages there isn't much you can say, because I think for most of us in those early stages, the well-meaning reassurances that people try to offer us ring pretty hollow when the pain is at its worst.
I think that's absolutely right, that if we can just let ourselves know that there's really nothing that we can say, but we can be there,
mm-hmm.
and we can listen. And we can love and we can have compassion. But to try to give advice or to try to preach or to try to say things like, well, he's in a better place now, none of that really helps somebody who is grieving, especially in the acute phases.
It can actually hurt, can't it? That...
Well, I think what it does is it distances you mm-hmm. from the other person. It's like kind of closes the door a little bit.
Well, you know, society, as you well know, Joyce, is full of, how shall I put it, offers of false hope, false reassurance, easy answers. That doesn't really work in a situation like this, does it?
You mean when somebody who is bereaved?
Well, just that, you know, that he's in a better place, he would have wanted to it this way, you know, things like that. The hollow ring that those things can have, because they sometimes reassurances can be a little superficial, is what I'm saying, I guess.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. We say things that we think we might want to hear,
yeah,
but that isn't necessarily what the other person wants to hear or needs to hear. And so, you know, as bereavement counselors, we listen, and we teach. We teach a little bit about grief, and that so many people who come to our grief groups think that something's wrong with them. They're going crazy. They haven't been able to make decisions. They can't seem to move forward. And the truth is, they just have to walk through this journey. And we offer support. We offer love. We offer compassion. We offer a little bit of education of what happens, what is the grief process, so that people hopefully can realize they're not going crazy. In fact, what they're going through is very normal, and it's called grief.
There's a component of anxiety to all this. You know, I'm thinking of Roosevelt's line about nothing to fear but fear itself, that
mm-hmm.
with pain, there's pain, and then there's fear of what pain is doing to you, and that's something else, isn't it?
There is pain, there is fear. I think a lot of the fears in the grieving process have to do with, how am I going to survive?
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do without this person? What you know, if there's financial issues around the death, that brings up a lot of fear, and then anxiety. You're absolutely right. Yeah,
but anxiety is a little bit easier to control than grief, don't you think?
It
kind of really depends on the person's experience with life and if they've been through grief before, if they're a person who has a tendency to be anxious anyway. And I think what happens is when people are depressed or when they're anxious, our society has a tendency to give a person medication to help them get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can sometimes make it worse because it's covering up their grief. And if people don't deal with their grief, it will linger inside.
Joyce,
it will come back.
It sounds as if what you're saying is that there's a certain amount of the pain of loss that just has to be experienced and gotten through, right?
That's exactly how we feel in hospice, that the pain that is accompanying the grief and the pain that goes along with the grief needs to be experienced. I have a saying in my grief groups, never miss an opportunity to cry, because crying allows one, it allows that grief to come out. It allows its healing for people. And, of course, in our culture, people don't want to cry. Not everybody, of course, but
I think that's opening up for a lot of people, Joyce, and it's probably all to the good.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for taking the time this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Joyce Lechuga is a psychologist who will offer a free workshop on reconnecting with life after loss in 5 free Thursday evening sessions at Hospice Maui in Wailuku starting this Thursday. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
She is something to behold, elegant and bold. She is electricity running to my soul.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue
and breakthrough
sky.
Moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
Weekdays from noon to 2.
Beth Ann, you know, it's frequently said that the incivility has crept into the election process this year, but it's nothing new in American politics. I'm thinking back to some of the things that candidates said about each other back in the 19th century. They would curl your hair. But Neil Conan reminded us that it's not the first time parties have seemed to implode, and then in the 60s, the Democrats were looking as if they were in a very disrupted state.
And maybe this idea that there's this myth that we perpetuate that we don't do nastiness in Hawaii, that's long been quashed. Anyway, we're going to pick up tomorrow and talk more. We're going to get an update on the Sunshine and Good Government bills with Brian Black, the executive director of the Civil Beat Law Center for the Public Interest. And we're going to be speaking with senior PBS NewsHour writer Mike Mosaitig.
And we're going to look at a long-running seed and plant exchange on Hawaii.
Meantime, we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want to hear any of our past shows, you can find them all on the HPR2 archive, along with more information about guests and topics on the show. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.